Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, the brand new co-working space in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Learn more at 100bogart.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Ooh, I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. Today happens to be Super Bowl Sunday, and I have a fun little fact. As you're gnawing down on buffalo wings tonight, and if you're wondering why they're so delicious, you might be surprised. Actually, you might know this. It's not that big of a secret, but so the sauce, that delicious buffalo wing sauce, which I happen to think is one of the most delicious flavors in the world, is actually 50% two things. It's half part Frank's Red Hot sauce or whatever, some other brand of Red Hot sauce or Tabasco sauce is fine too. And the next ingredient is butter. And that's what makes it so delicious. So I'm really excited to be talking about all things butter with the author of Butter, A Rich History. It is Elaine Kasrova, and she's joining us today in the station. Hi.
Hi.
Thanks so much for coming down.
Great to be here.
Thank so you came down from Butterland, Hudson, New York.
That's right, in the Hudson Valley. I actually live between two dairy farms on a dirt road up there, so I'm surrounded by the idea of butter as well as butter itself.
And you're a longtime food writer, test kitchen editor, so you've been in around food for a long time, but you write in your introduction that, you know, you sort of always just took butter for granted. It's there. And you know, I think the most, like, one of the interesting things about butter these days, too, is that you find it everywhere, from high to low cuisine, greasy spoon diners, yes, to the finest chefs are making their own house-made butter and so forth. It's like a very unifying ingredient.
Yeah, but it's just the fact that it is so common and so available that makes us take it for granted. And as you said, I was guilty of that for most of my career. And it wasn't until I was working as editor of the cheese magazine Culture, so this was a few years ago. And so I was getting to sample different kinds of butter from around the world and different types of butter, like higher fat butter and cultured butter and whey butter and sheep butter, goat butter. And I remember being sort of astonished at one point, realizing, wow, this is essentially one ingredient, cream, butter, fat, you know, give or take salt, put through a really simple process of agitation. Mm-hmm. There's many different ways you can agitate, but it's just that simple.
Sure.
And so why was I experiencing some butters that were kind of greasy and others that were more firm? Some had a lot of butteriness while others were a little flatter in flavor. There were tangy butters. There were different colored butters. So I just began to suddenly be aware of this range of experience. And I couldn't account for it as a longtime food writer. Like, what's actually going on here? So it was the craft and science of butter making that really drew me to the topic first.
And maybe that's because you were given the task of trying these different butters that were unique.
Right.
Instead of like this very homogenized staple that I grew up eating and you see everywhere.
Yes, yes.
Too.
Right. When I grew up, there was basically two kinds of butter in the supermarket, and they were identical. They probably were even made in the same industrial plant. But, you know, now we have this wonderful variety of imported butters. We still have, of course, the industrial ones, and I want to make a point that we're really lucky to have such good standardized butter to some degree. I love artisanal butters. I love trying them, but the industrialized butter, especially if they come from a good sort of grass-fed co-op, milk co-op, like they do in Ireland and New Zealand, you know, they do amazing butter. It's so consistent. Your cookies always come out the same. You know, your cakes, your buttercream.
That's
creams. A feat. Yeah. So that's really great. I my book makes a point of, you know, we shouldn't just be all about artisanal butters, even though those have become a way for dairy farmers to, you know, have value-added product that can maybe support their lifestyle a little bit better on these small dairy farms. So it's really taking, you know, a new direction, and actually a new old direction.
Nice, yeah. Yeah, butter, any way you slice it, is such a fascinating product, which I didn't realize until reading this book. Well, I mean, you know, we love butter.
Yeah.
Kind of did, but you examine butter from so many angles in this book, societal, spiritual, scientific, and you write how the story of butter really underscores the story of us.
Of us, yes.
You write, one of the oldest man-made edibles, butter's history is our history.
That's right, yeah, because it has intersected with so much of what we are about. So, as you said, you know, religion, spirituality, there's a whole chapter on that in my book. Agriculture, gender politics, you
love
know,
those sections.
National politics, you know, science, craft, so many ways in, you know, way we do things and why we do things that butter has intersected with. So it's a little bit like a lens on, you know, mankind's history through butter. And that's how it felt for me when I was doing the research. It was really, really fascinating.
So let's start with back to the basics. When people first made butter, you have this lovely passage about this nomadic family in Tibet and how they gathered the milk in the morning from a yak.
Yes.
And it sounded like an amazing just feat of skillfulness and carefulness dealing with the yak and bringing along a calf so she was comfortable, because, you know, these animals want to save their milk for their young.
Yes, right. It's a little trick to having the milk be let down by the mother.
Right.
But yeah, so I went to Bhutan to really witness yak butter making as it has been done for thousands of years. It really hasn't changed among the herding population in the high altitude of Bhutan. So my husband and I went there and camped alongside this family so we could see the daily ritual of gathering the milk from the yak. And yeah, it's as it was for so many thousands of years, it's women's work. Essentially, the woman in the family did all the milking. She did all the processing of the milk into butter, mostly butter, but they also made cheese sometime. The husband, honestly, I'm not sure what he did.
You're like, I'm observing him do nothing.
I know he told the dogs to tell the yak to go graze at some point, but he spent a lot of time around the fire.
Oh,
yeah. So
okay, let's talk about you write, and I didn't realize this either. Like when we think of butter and milk, we think of, you know, dairy maids, butter churn, and you know, it's a woman's world.
Yes.
But you write how, you know, women single-handedly are really responsible for much of the innovations and the craft of butter making throughout forever.
Yes.
Until maybe the last, well, we'll talk about that later,
till we hit the
century.
Until the late 1800s. What I found in my research was that almost universally, it was taboo for men to have anything to do with milking and processing milk because it was so closely connected with birthing and lactation and fertility. So it was very much a female domain. And again, this was around the world. I found this to be the case. So
crazy.
Women were they founded the dairy industry, cheese making, butter making.
And when we talk about women, we're not talking about like business women. We're talking about like people who are otherwise mothers and doing other stuff.
Farm wives, for sure. Many, many farm wives, but also the dairy maids, because being a dairy maid was one of the few jobs a woman could find, actually, outside of a home.
And did they invent butter, you think, Oh, wait, no. You write that butter was sort of an accident, right?
Yes. So if you go back to, you know, Stone Age mm-hmm. butter, we don't know for sure. We'll never really know for sure. But what we speculate is that at some point, a shepherd's family mm-hmm. had put the milk from either, you know, it would have been a yak or sheep or goat. It wouldn't have been a cow because cows were domesticated much later. Mm-hmm. But would have put that milk into an animal sack to store it and then was transporting it, presumably, on the
their
back of an animal.
Thing, yeah.
Yeah, so it would have been in an animal sack, the mm-hmm. milk, because that's what they used to carry, you know, the liquid they collected. And so just in transporting this sack, say, over the hill and vale, uh-huh. it would have been rocked back and forth. That's a form of agitation. That's a kind of churning. And so lo and behold, when they opened it up, you know, there were these morsels of fat floating on top. Uh-huh. And we, you know, I doubt it happened in one place and then spread. I think it probably happened
all the time.
Yeah.
And wait, in colder climates, did they make ice cream accidentally? Churn? No.
Yeah, okay. I don't doubt that.
that's mm-hmm. fascinating. But no, mm-hmm. but you write that, you know, women are credited with, you know, preserving the milk in various ways through cheese making, mm-hmm. butter making, salting the butter to preserve it.
Yes, it was pickled butter. So they would picture a, you know, really salty brine, and they would have mounded these balls of butter and kept them in this brine. Because think of it, they didn't have any refrigeration. And at the time when milk is most abundant, you know, spring and summer, that's when the temperatures mm-hmm. are rising. So, and you have this sudden flow of milk and butterfat, and you have to capture it and you have to preserve it. So, you know, in the wintertime, it's cold and it wouldn't be a problem. But if you're making, you know, butter every single day and it's June and July and August, you have to figure out a way to preserve that mm-hmm. windfall of butter.
Mm-hmm.
And so heavily salting it, I mean, sometimes it was packed into firkins and molds and things, and it would have been at least four times as salty as the saltiest butter that we have now.
And then
now.
They rinsed it afterwards?
Yeah, they could, like you do with salted fish, you can soak it in water to try to leach out some of that salt so it's a bit more edible.
Wait, why did this not catch on as much? That sounds good. Does anybody still make salted fermented? Isn't it?
We have refrigeration now, not so much. That doesn't really happen.
All right, so let's cut ahead. So women are, this is a woman's world, making mm-hmm. butter
mm.
and developing it over the years.
Which, by the way, you know, want to mention too that it gave a lot of women in rural areas on the farm. It also helped give them a social outlet if they were going to market with their butter.
So this
sort of fabric of their life was helped. Their social life was helped created by butter, and also women could be very entrepreneurial about it. They had beautiful molds if they wanted to sort of trademark their butter if it was good butter.
That's right. Yeah.
They would get cash in hand. You know, they could do sort of marketing tricks in the. As they were selling their butter, and some women went door to door, and you know, basically caught up on the neighbors' gossip and all.
Mm-hmm.
So it really, like I write in my book about it. You know, the fabric of their lives was helped by butter making.
It was greased
along, smoothed along. Yeah, and how much that changed when suddenly, you know, in the late 1800s, men invaded the dairy because they wanted to beef
speed
production
up. But first, I want to get back to that point where it was taboo for men to deal with butter. And you found this around the world, that being the
mm-hmm.
case.
Yes.
And
I witnessed it in Bhutan and in India. I was in India mm-hmm. as well. You could still see that women were doing it all.
And the Western world, too.
Mm-hmm.
But,
oh, yeah.
Was it,
yeah
just,
it was a little bit less so, you know, in the early states, you know, when the colonists came here, because there was such short labor force mm-hmm. and everybody had to pitch in.
Right,
so there was much less sort of gender politics around it mm-hmm. in the New World.
Was there religion politics around it too? Like you're saying?
As far as production of butter, I didn't identify that precisely. Not precisely. You know, the religion and butter for me and my research was much more about how all peoples, used it as a sacred tool.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. It's just funny that, you know, you think, okay, well, this is a female cow. It lactates like you do. So you
right.
I'm kidding. But it's also a very, you know, it's not like physically, it's not like it's not physically demanding, you know.
This yeah.
is like
oh, yeah.
carrying
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah. Right.
Milking.
Yeah, it was hard work. That's why I write about how ironic it is that dairy maids have this kind of semi-erotic.
Right. What's up with that?
You know, reputation.
Yeah.
Yeah. This image of the dairy maid. And yet, they were strong, tough women, you know.
Weren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, they were milking in the fields. They had like a yoke they wore on their, a wooden yoke to carry mm-hmm. their pails of milk and all through all kinds of weather. And they were tough.
They were tough.
And yet, they were sort of glamorized by, you know, artists and people had this, you know, I think because they were so closely connected to fertility. It was, you know, that whole realm. And men didn't understand how women, you know, took this liquid, went into the dairy, and then it emerged as butter and cheese. Like, they knew women could do this. And to some degree, they took it for granted, of course. But there was a little bit of this, like, magic. Like, what's going on in there? How do they do mm-hmm. this? So I think that plays into the stereotype of the dairy maid.
And the associations continue to this day. I was looking at this little packet of butter, mm-hmm. Land O'Lakes, the other day, and I was like, dude, what is up with this, like, Native American girl on the cover? I want to talk a little bit more about that. Like, what happened after the marketing, mass marketing and industrialization of butter? Mm. But you see those relics of that female association.
Oh, yeah. You see it around the world.
Okay. So right after a quick little commercial break, and be right back chatting more with Elaine Kasruba.
Mm. 100 Bogart Street is finally open and ready for Bushwick. 100 Bogart is a brand new, state-of-the-art co-working space that provides turnkey workspaces, including open layout desks, meeting spaces, and furnished private offices. Members have access to top-notch amenities such as custom furniture, high-speed internet, spacious kitchenettes with coffee and tea, printers, scanners, and much more. Alongside their professional work environment, 100 Bogart also provides exclusive educational programming for any curious entrepreneur. Heritage Radio Network has made their new office home at 100 Bogart and will host many events there in the future. For more information about their co-working space, visit 100bogart.com and become a member to network, create, and educate.
Your lips are parched. Please do not quench them with your teeth. For I'll return.
All right, we're back chatting more with Elaine Kasruba. She's written Butter, A Rich History. We love this book. We were just talking about how butter... Okay, now we're talking about the ascension of butter from this traditionally farm wives mm-hmm. product into the Industrial Revolution. You write that it was a very relatively quick leap for this mm-hmm. product mm-hmm. to go from an artisanal, I guess we could say now, product to a mass-produced one.
Yeah, when you think that butter had been made more or less the same way for thousands of years, and then suddenly along came this invention called the cream separator, and that mm-hmm. really just revolutionized the entire industry, because now farmers, dairy manners, small or big, didn't have to wait the 24 to 36 hours it took for cream to traditionally, you know, to rise to the top of the milk. Milk would be set in pails and pans and troughs, and people would have to wait this very long time for the cream to rise to the top, at which point then it could be skimmed off, and then you kept collecting those skimmings until you had enough to make butter. So that's the way it was done for many years. Although I will say, in places like India and Bhutan, they churn the whole milk. They would ferment whole milk like a yogurt-type product and churn the whole milk. But, you know, in Europe and in the States, the tradition was always to skim the cream off. So along came this cream separator in the late 1800s, and suddenly you could have fresh cream. That was more or less a new product, fresh cream because it works by centrifugal force. So you put the milk in, and because of the different weights of the fat, the molecular weight, the fat comes out one spout, and the more liquid portion comes out the other, and now you suddenly have fresh cream.
Wow.
So that really, yes. And what's interesting is the Chinese figured this out something in like 900 AD that you could do this, but it didn't hit the dairy world.
Wow.
Until that, you know, that many centuries
later. Were they using that
later.
For milk, for cream, for butter?
No, not in China. No, yeah, they were. But they understood how using centrifugal force could separate things. So the theory of centrifugal force was ancient, but it didn't hit the dairy world till late 1800s. So I write my book about it. Suddenly, you know, butter leaves the farm.
Uh-huh.
It's not profitable anymore for wives and, you know, dairy maids to make it there. So it makes more sense for them to just collect their milk, you know, put it in the wagon, bring it to a local creamery. So because of the separator, these local creameries suddenly appeared. They were a new thing where farmers came along and got paid for their milk by the pound. And that at the creamery, they had the separators and they could just make it right there. I mean, there were farm wives who got a small separator and still did it at home. It wasn't just like universally gone. But, you know, it shifted
things.
That's the
most profitable way to do it.
Right.
Most efficient.
Mm-hmm.
So also to compare butter making then throughout much of history and now, we have cows that produce more milk.
Lots more milk. Like thousands of gallons more milk in lactation. And that has everything to do with breeding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, tons of, you know, innovation as far as breeding on many generations of cows. I think you might have this. My brain doesn't exactly remember this stat, but I compared a 14th century cow lactation to modern, and it's just off the charts difference.
Wow. Yeah. And also, you didn't have to herd, or you didn't have as many nomadic herders trying to like capture this, you know, and then bring along a calf. But you write that, you know, Holstein's is typically the most high-yielding milking cow.
Right.
But smaller farms, more artisanal ones that look for flavor, perhaps over yield.
Mm-hmm.
You write that Dan Barber of Stone Barns and Blue Hill was trying out making like single
udder.
Breed cow.
Single udder
butters to see which one was best.
Yes. Yeah. I haven't gotten to sample them, but I think his contention
single udder
butter.
Butter.
Say that very fast. his contention is that absolutely there was a difference. It makes sense because the health of a cow, the period of lactation that she's in, what she's eating, you know, all these things, there are many subtle variables that affect a butter and the milk fat, you know, within the milk, the volume and the quality, so forth. Yeah, and there are breeds, you know, if you want to make cheese and make butter, Holstein is generally not the best breed for you.
Okay.
You know, you want Jersey or Guernsey cows, and, you know, in Europe there's Brown Swiss, you know, there's
you
other
that
ones.
That Hawthorne Valley was using the Brown Swiss near you?
Yes.
Okay, in Hudson?
Yeah. He's a German farmer, so he was partial to I think, you know, mostly I see a lot of Jersey cows among buttermakers and cheesemakers.
That's interesting. Do you know if there's any, like, rising star breed for today's, I guess,
Well, you're seeing more Guernsey, too.
Okay.
Guernseys have a beautiful milk. It's almost tinged a little bit golden because they have a high quantity of milk fat in there. And also, you know, the goldenness of it has to do with how much beta carotene is kind of hidden
the
in
grass,
the milk.
Right,
the grass that they're fed. So that has a lot to do with the color, how they're fed.
Mm-hmm. So more and more, or I don't know, what is the state of grass-fed milk nowadays? It's becoming more popular.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. And it's still, you know, a farmer can, if you know, feed their herd a little bit of grass and call it grass-fed.
Sure.
There's no real regulation around it. you really kind of got to do your research. If it says grass-fed and grass-finished and pastured, you know, if there's all pastured, these kinds of
terms,
statements you have to look for if you want the real thing. I think it's a label that's easily corrupted out there, and you don't exactly know what you're getting. But there is a difference nutritionally, and, you know, if you also believe politically in animals being out on grass and eating what their nature is to eat, you know, it's worth doing the homework. But
I found it interesting. I didn't realize this, but, you know, nowadays most cows are not, you know, fed. They're weaned from their mothers, and they're not given the milk, because why? Right. We're taking the milk from
exactly.
it too.
So
they're also artificially inseminated too. So all these things are.
It's a real factory.
Yeah,
it really truly is a real factory. That's why when I've sometimes been confronted by vegans as a butter writer, I know they have a really good point. You know, they really, the industrial model of keeping animals is, it's shameful in my view. But there are alternatives, and not everyone is doing that.
Right.
And as you know, I live up in the Hudson Valley, and many dairy farmers who love their animals and treat them well and let the calves nurse with the mother, and, you know, do this negotiation that has gone on for centuries because people, especially people in northern climates, you know, absolutely needed animal products to survive. They didn't have the growing season. They had to have animal products, but they had to take care of the health of those animals at the same time. So they learned, you know, the best practices in negotiating with this creature, so that both could survive.
Right.
And
be healthy.
You know, right. So there is a model out there. It's, you know, it's rare, but there is a model out there.
In general, if butter is more yellow or golden, does that mean that they've been eating more grass that season, or, you know, because the beta carotenes?
Yes.
That is a thing?
In general.
Okay.
But people should know that goat butter and sheep butter will always be white. And that has to do with the way the animal takes the beta carotene in their feed in the grass and converts it to vitamin A, which is colorless. So it still has good nutrition, because vitamin A is, you know, vitamin A. And beta carotene is a precursor
orange.
To vitamin A. But it won't ever be yellow.
Okay.
Some producers, there's a producer in England that naturally colors their goat butter so it doesn't look so white, because it tends to look like lard.
Oh.
And it's not as appealing. You know, people definitely like yellow butter.
Yeah.
And so you sometimes see, you know, a little natural food coloring, annatto on the goat butter.
We didn't talk too much about this. Okay, that's one of the big differences, I think, between the fake margarines and Oleo products. Has that crazy weird golden color and also that unnaturally smooth consistency.
Yes. Yeah.
So the last century was not very kind to butter. I mean, in a popular culture, it was thought to be not good for you, it was certainly not fat free.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's come around though.
It really took a beating in the 20th century. I grew up in the second half of the 20th century. Well, I grew up in the 70s, and, you know, fat was just demonized, any kind of fat, but particularly saturated fat. And so, you know, that's when margarine really started to take over the market. Because, you know, it seems so healthy. It's a vegetable oil product, right? You know, what could be wrong with that? But now we know, you know, that when you take vegetable oils and you adulterate them, you know, to make hydrogenated fat, which is turning a
trans fat,
turning a liquid oil into a solid fat, as they do with margarine, is creating these trans fats. So, you know, there we were, so many people eating what they thought was healthier that was actually doing them a lot of damage. You know, and we see still the result of that today. I mean, heart disease, really, we've hardly made any progress, you know, as far as people having less heart disease. What we've gotten good at is like stents and and bypasses and the plumbing around the heart, but actual heart disease because so much of our food supply has been corrupted with, you know, sugar and trans fats, which really, those are two risky things when you talk about the health of your arteries. And so it's not butter per se. In fact, you know, real good grass-fed butter has things that actually protect you from heart disease, believe it or not. There's so much amazing information now coming out about saturated fat and this, how, what a big category of fat it is, and how, you know, anybody that just sort of lumps it all together and says, oh, it's not good for you, really, it does, either doesn't know what they're talking about or is just not telling you the truth. Mm-hmm. But it takes, I have a degree in food and nutrition. Mm-hmm. It's an old degree. It's from when I was told to tell people not to eat fat. Oh. But I am able to kind of work through these articles and research papers to understand all the cool stuff now. And it's just wonderful. But I want to pull my hair out because you still go to the store and there's all these low fat, no fat labels everywhere. You know, we're still stuck in that to some degree.
We've still been brainwashed to some degree.
Yeah, and actually the medical establishment seems like the last to come along. Like there's still so many doctors that say, you know, stay away from butter.
You got, there's so much more to talk about, but the interesting thing, I think, you know, I've read a lot about the controversy of good fat, bad fat, butter is good for you, bad for you anyway. But what you bring to this debate is a really interesting... the gender politics of it, because for so long, you know, butter was a woman's product, and then when men came along and industrialized it, you know, there was many studies you saw, or like some sort of articles, and what did you write? Historical records of the time with, you know, disparaging remarks about dairy women's backward customs, how they interfered with the advancements and so forth. And you write that the advancements and also the margarine revolution was sort of like a man's world type of thing.
Absolutely. And it was all about creating this big, giant commodity. You know, women were really never about that. Making more and bigger production. Of course, they wanted to make money and do well.
And it's a cheaper product, emptier of...
Well, and the other thing, you know, people don't know, and I didn't know till I did my research, was that one of the reasons margarine started to take off, and this would have been in the late 1800s, early 1900s, was because there was so much bad butter out there. Butter that would spoil.
Not consistent butter.
And if you were a person, with little income, the best you could afford was bad butter, rancid butter, could be dirty, you know, just not good butter. And then margarine, which at that time was made from beef fat. Mm. It was made originally from beef fat and milk and salt and a little bit of coloring. So it was actually a pretty natural product. Didn't have the trans fats that we created later on. So, that was partly why people took to margarine.
Yeah.
So
it's also golden and glowing there like a halo effect.
Right. Add an affinato. It's really yellow.
Well, we've come such a long way in our butter evolution. I can't wait to see where it goes next. And I know that there's so much more to talk to you about. Looks like we're out of time. Oh, man. I hope you come out with a sequel, though.
Oh, well, I'd like to see there's a lot of butter traditions in North Africa that I really wanted to research. I have a little bit of that in my book, but yeah, I'd love to do more on this topic. It's amazing.
This is an amazing topic. I hope everyone gets their hands on Butter, A Rich History. It's out in paperback now, so no reason not to.
Yes.
And thank you so much, Elaine, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. That I ain't never, 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 never had no loving like this before.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.